Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 20th of April. This hour of the program, we have two guests with us. Dr. Michael Wollner is a forensic psychiatrist, a consultant for ABC News, and has a great deal to say about the videos of Sung-Wee Cho. A little bit later this hour, Barbara Oakley, a professor of engineering at Oakland University, who wrote an op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times talking about how our universities are able to deal with horror as a literary subject, but not as a fact of life. Can administrators, she asks, and deans really continue to leave professors and other college personnel to deal with deeply disturbed students on their own? We'll be welcoming phone calls for all of our guests this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Dr. Michael Wollner was on ABC's Good Morning America. And he was referring to the videos of Sung-Wee Cho, saying if anybody cares about the victims in Blacksburg and if anybody cares about their children, stop showing this video now. Take it off the internet. Let it be relegated to YouTube. This is a social catastrophe. Showing the video is a social catastrophe. We'll talk about why he feels that way. He is chair of the Forensic Panel, a national forensic science practice, and an associate professor of psychiatry at NYU's School of Medicine. His casework has spanned the range of criminal, civil, employment, and securities law, and he has pioneered the effort toward establishing a clinical and forensic standardization of evil acts. It's called the Depravity Scale, and it's a history and evidence-driven forensic instrument that will standardize the definition of heinous, atrocious, and cruel for purposes of fair and consistent application in criminal sentencing. He specializes in his New York City clinical practice in patients who fail to respond to treatment. He's also, well, his list of accomplishments goes on and on. We'll welcome phone calls. He's with us for a few moments here, so call in if you know that you would like to speak with him. Dr. Michael Wollner, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell me about what you mean. You said this not once, but twice. To show this video is a social catastrophe, a social catastrophe. Why?
Well, I want to make it clear that it's not just the video, but it's the audio and it's the pictures. There are a couple of reasons. One relates to the victim, and one relates to the fallout. With respect to the victims, and this relates to just disaster medicine and what we've come to learn, that the family members, those who've been traumatized, who have been affected, cannot feel unsafe. They cannot feel powerless, and they cannot feel menaced by the person responsible for this. And when you empower someone and put yourself in the same position as the deceased, to have experienced his menace and to go through what they've gone through, it's toxic and it's actually sadistic. From a standpoint of the fallout, I would perhaps provide the analogy to your listeners of what would happen in a chemical spill. When there's a toxic release of gas, there is a surrounding community affected. And the longer that gas sits, then it seeps into the soil, and that people, cows eat it, and then people drink the milk from the cows, and then they develop illnesses. And the key point here is the longer that people are exposed to the ideas, the more they can identify with such an individual if they have problems themselves. I'm not talking about most folks who would find it horrifying, but that's not whom he's speaking to anyway. He's speaking to people whom he can inspire and to gain legitimacy and immortality. And we have to see beyond ourselves to recognize that there are many people who are struggling for heroes who find anti-heroes. And this is why it's not only important to reflect that these catastrophes live on forever, not the next day. They're not copied the day after. If you see incidents of people copycatting now and next week, it's more to just get their name in the paper and to attract some attention because the media is focusing. But there are people who will draw from this experience, and they will target next Columbine Day, next Hitler's birthday, next April 20th, next April 16th as some sort of anniversary or homage, and will plan and undertake these kinds of things, and they'll do it because they're seeking immortality too, and we can stop that by sending a message that we're not going to endow them with that kind of immortality.
And evidently, some of the networks heard your voice on this. They cut back on showing the video, and the size of the picture of this guy in the papers got smaller as the days went on. But the damage has already been done.
Well, you know, let's go back to the chemical spill. And I think it was very gratifying to have a role in igniting a public outcry on the Internet, in the blogosphere, to make a difference. And very quickly, these pictures, this film was yanked. It was again, gratifying to get that feedback and people saying the damage has been done. Again, look, if there's a chemical spill, there's a chemical spill, mm-hmm. but you can still have a role in keeping that chemical spill from continuing to seep and affecting a wider area. It's not just an issue of people getting exposed to something. It's also the continued readied access to something. There's pornography. You can find videos about cannibalism. If you want, you can go and watch Daniel Pearl get beheaded. But you got to go look for it.
Yeah.
And if you put it in front of people's faces, then they get continued exposure. And there's also something to the repetition of the exposure. And we saw attention focused on that after 9/11 with the buildings coming
mm-hmm.
down.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of repeated exposure, the trauma to the victims, the inspiration to the disaffected, that can be cut off at just the press of a button by webmasters. And even if it is on the Internet, why should a child who just goes up on their search engine, being MSN,
right.
for example,
right.
why should I see Cho pointing a gun at my face?
Right.
It's just inappropriate.
Yeah. It, for all of us, I looked at those. I had to walk into the other room when I saw those. They were all over that night. I was watching a lot of the news coverage, and it was just so unsettling. It made you sick to your stomach.
Well, you know, let me make the following suggestion, because you've given me the honor of being able to meet your listeners. Let this be an example for people to say, because this has been yanked off, to have a dialogue with their children about how it's inappropriate to stay away from people who think that you become a man by holding a gun and by being violent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, Don Imus was pulled off the air because sponsors got pulled off the air, and sponsors will not pay for certain media if the people don't want it. If your listeners decide, and it's something people can blog about, can communicate about. They don't need Dr. Wellner to be involved, but that they just will simply not take their children to violent movies and to have a discussion with
I'm
their children.
I'm with you.
Say,
I agree.
I'm worried, but
yep.
that's how this is going to stop, because people draw inspiration before there's a real figure like a Cho. There's a Bruce Willis, there's an Arnold Schwarzenegger, and now that mm-hmm. this is cross-cultural, then there will be a Wesley Snipes, and then there's some Jet Li kicking the hell out of somebody. The point is, there are all kinds of these destructive icons, and some of it may be art, and some of it may be cool. But the minute people turn the tap off of financial support, then they'll stop making movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy. Look, that's how they stopped suicide bombing in Sri Lanka. They stopped because it was such an embarrassment to the Sri Lankan expatriate community, in particular the Tamils, that the money dried up. And if there's no money to support violence, then the violence will not be exposed to children. And this is something that we as end users, as parents, you actually can have a hand in making a difference. This is the beauty of the world that we live in, that these things can ignite. And I want to encourage your listeners to draw from the experience of how fast this stuff got yanked off yesterday when people really started to mobilize, and turn your attention to Hollywood, not in a destructive way, but in a way where you just care about your own home and your friend's home, and you communicate with one another and say, you know what, listen, I'll give you money to go to the movies, but I'm asking you, please, don't see this, because I don't want you to follow these people.
Yeah.
Don't follow these people.
Good.
They're bad, and they end up in prison, and the world doesn't work that way.
Good advice. Can you tell me just a little bit, because there are teachers all over who struggle, and we all have neighbors, and we know people who seem to be disturbed, and I know that you have a depravity scale that I want you to talk about in a moment, but so many teachers realize that they were dealing with a really, really, really troubled guy. Signs of psychosis they were seeing. He was hospitalized for a while. They had to tell people, listen, I'm going to tutor him, but if I say the name of a professor, it's a indication that I'm in trouble, you need to come and see me. First of all, teachers shouldn't have to do this, but how do we deal with people who are extremely disturbed, be they in our classrooms, on our lives somehow? There were all kinds of signs that this guy he needed significant help. Maybe he needed to be in a hospital for a long time, Dr. Wellner.
I think this is a difficult stage in our history, and I'm actually writing an article about this for ABCnews.com right now as I'm taking this call, that I think there's a need, I spoke about it this morning on Good Morning America, there's a need to bring paranoia, and in particular schizophrenia, out of the closet, the same way we've succeeded with depression, with panic disorder, with eating disorders. There's a tremendous stigma associated with schizophrenia. Let me tell you how this unfortunately affects things at the end-user level. Psychiatrists, I'm not just talking about people, psychiatrists are afraid of straight talk with their patients about schizophrenia because schizophrenia has such a stigma attached to it of the chronicity of the illness. The problem is, like cancer, like diabetes, which has less of a strong feeling attached to it, there are treatments which can improve quality of life, even if they can't remedy an illness.
Mm-hmm.
And by a person not getting treatment for schizophrenia, then it worsens the prognosis. And the doctors, because they're afraid of uttering the S word, and in part because a young male who finds out he has schizophrenia, it is a catastrophic experience for him psychologically to try to process that. And I want to issue a plea, a challenge to my mental health colleagues to stop being afraid of the S word. And we have to bring schizophrenia out in a way where we're just frank and candid with the patients, because in my professional opinion, when all is said and done, we're going to see that he was a schizophrenic, that because it was early in his disease course, it wasn't readily recognized, but also that mental health professionals and others around him were more willing to call it, say, depression or, quote, troubled, because this gives them a sense that it is more remediable. If you don't confront the significance of an illness head on, you're not going to treat it successfully. If you want to treat cancer like an infection, you're going to get cancer in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly the same way with dealing with psychosis. And this is, and that's why I'm saying this is at a difficult state. Until you make it easier for a patient to accept the burden of his diagnosis without feeling he's necessarily stigmatized, you'll never keep him in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be too much of a blow to his self-esteem of a vulnerable college male to say, you know what, I can't deal with having this condition, which is chronic, so I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience of practice, this is what happens now, that a young person with a paranoid condition such as schizophrenia just doesn't want to deal with it, so they deny it, and they know if they stay away from psychiatrists, they never have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So they go untreated, their deterioration progresses, and in a small minority of these people, they actually get violent, and in certain cases, catastrophically so.
Mm. What is the depravity scale?
The depravity scale is very important to your audience. It is a research undertaking that has been inspired by forensic science standards and legal case decisions, and is now urging public participation at www.depravityscale.org in order to define which aspects of intent, actions, attitudes, and victim choice distinguish the worst of the worst crimes so that we can have fair and consistent sentencing, so that the most evil of crimes are defined as such fairly, and so that cases that really should be given consideration as not being like other crimes aren't overcharged and cases aren't hyped. The reason I feel so strongly about this, and the reason your listeners need to participate, they need to have their voice heard, is because this is a democratic type of research. It's a landmark protocol, and that it's the first forensic science protocol that has ever been undertaken toward public policy that directly involves citizen input. And in my professional opinion, if you have people involved in setting standards for very sensitive aspects of justice, people will have more confidence in the justice system when they're on juries or if they have family members who are in the system. If people have misgivings about the system, well, here's a solution. You have to get involved. This is a protocol to encourage that. So at www.depravityscale.org, I would very much encourage your listeners to log on and to participate. And I can already tell you, lawmakers are watching the data, and it won't be overnight, but you will see that their voices are heard.
Is there anything you can say that will reassure teachers? Can we, do we need some kind of guidelines, once again, dealing with students who appear to be very, very disturbed? I think that a lot of them are kind of nervous these days. What can they do? And if they've already spotted a troubled student and tried to do something to no avail, that's not good.
I appreciate your question, and there are several suggestions that I can make. First of all, let me point out what teachers really need to be concerned about. Somebody may be guarded and somebody may be suspicious, but beyond suspiciousness, someone who clearly has a contempt for everyone around them is a person that is at greater risk.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who dehumanizes is at greater risk. You cannot kill a stranger unless you have contempt and you're dehumanizing toward them. So these are qualities that if a teacher picks up on, they need to be dealt with and engaged in a way where that dehumanization is diffused. It's as simple as giving chocolates and candy and catering to someone's sweet side in order to cultivate it. And I'm not trying to be a homie and give you chicken soup for the soul, but sometimes the notion of inspiring an appreciation for humanity is the antidote to at least keeping dehumanization from progressing and advancing that much further. That's item one. And then it's the fascination with weapons as icons of masculinity. Here's something every teacher who listens to your program can do. Get working on cultivating in students role models who are anything but violent.
Mm.
And I'm not talking about Mahatma Gandhi. No kid's going to look up to somebody running around in a robe and wearing funny glasses. This isn't something that they can relate to. These are something that high-minded academics can relate to, but something that kids can relate to as people that they want to be like. And it's clear that a teacher finds this adaptable to contemporary culture. There are loads of role models like this all over where people can say, I am somebody, I can be somebody, and I can be like that person. And you know what? I'm going to be like that person. Think about the person who inspired you to get into broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we all have people along our chosen pathways.
We sure do. Mm-hmm.
That are role models, and if teachers gear students along that pathway, they give students somebody, even someone who's picked on. They give them someone to attach themselves to, and to build themselves around, and to help them find their way. And this is even a healthy way to keep them from attaching themselves to negative peers or some of the elements of entertainment culture that glorify guns and cheapen women. And in this sense, listen, as long as the teachers have them in the class, they got them captive. Nobody else to listen to unless they've got headphones on. So make it count. And I think the role models, if the teacher themselves can't be a role model, and that's a lot to ask of anybody, it's an enormous it's an enormous task to be a role model to everybody in the class, but be focused and sensitive to the idea that kids of all ages need people to look up to,
mm-hmm.
and the kids who don't have that at home because their parents, for whatever reason, aren't succeeding as role models, they're especially vulnerable in their adolescence to what kind of role models are going to emerge for them. And you do not want it to be the big kid who's cool, who smokes pot, who's in the other homeroom. No. There is that can be shaped, and teachers have. I don't want to phrase this in terms of responsibility. That it's not a burden. It's a potential. It's a potential that they actually have the tiger by the tail.
Thank you so much for being with us and making time for us this morning, Dr. Wellner.
That's quite all right. I appreciate it, and perhaps I'll be back one day, and I appreciate your interest.
Great. Yeah, I hope you will be back one day. Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Michael Wellner, our guest this hour. He does a great deal of work in criminal, civil employment, and securities law, is responsible for a number of groundbreaking innovations in forensic science. He, as founder and chair of the forensic panel, devised and implemented the first peer review protocols in the U.S. for forensic consultation. You've probably seen him on television a great deal the last couple days. He is a consultant for ABC News and had a lot to say about the showing of the video of the killer at Virginia Tech, and he's on a lot of national television shows. He gave that, again, he wanted us to stress this depravity scale that you can vote and it is depravityscale.org. We're going to pause for a moment and return and speak with Professor Barbara Oakley, professor of engineering at Oakland University. And she talks about troubled students. And this was in a piece in yesterday's New York Times op-ed section. So we'll speak with her in just a moment and take phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Barbara Oakley is joining us now on the Ideas Network, professor of engineering at Oakland University, author of the forthcoming book, Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend. She wrote a very interesting piece in the Times yesterday in which she talks about students, and particularly a gift from a student, a sticky note on her door glued to the middle, a cockroach, later told that the cockroach was a symbol of love. And she talks about this student who moved into the lab across the hall from her office, spent the nights in sleeping bags under one of the benches, and had been a student for more than a decade, whiled away his time discussing guns and explosives with, as she writes, some of the more munitions-inclined faculty members, and kept his basement stocked with a variety of armaments. He watched her all the time, sometimes followed her out to her car. There were other people who were concerned about his behavior. So she writes about this and writes about evil in this piece in the Times yesterday. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Barbara, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. Professor Barbara Oakley, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. I'm glad to be here.
So how long did this kind of behavior go on? This guy's leaving cockroaches on your door and talking about his guns, and he's got all kinds of guns in the basement. I'd be a little afraid. Most people would be a little afraid by this kind of behavior.
Well, it was early on in my career as a faculty member, and I think these kind of students who are disturbed often can detect when professors are new and sort of fresh meat, so to speak. Mm. And so I think it took me about a year to figure out as this person sort of started spending more time around me and so forth, that this was an individual who really had some problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very difficult situation, and I guess I can empathize with the administration because, to some extent, they just want to make the problem go away. It hasn't been there until I made an issue of it, really.
Hmm.
And so, at any rate, it was quite a long time, nearly a year.
Oh my!
Where this kind of thing was going on and kind of getting worse.
And you talked to the administration. You also talked to the police about this guy's behavior.
I went to some department chairs and spoke with them and got some support because I had asked around, what am I supposed to do in this kind of situation?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I'd like to bring out is I think a lot of universities really don't have policies that they communicate to professors about what to do in this kind of situation. And I do think that written policies that are communicated would make a big difference. I think a lot of professors like myself just kind of flounder around asking around, who do I talk to about this problem? So at any rate, ended up going to one of the administrators and really not getting very much support.
Hmm.
And I think part of that is, if they're not sort of, I hate to say it, but directly on the firing line, it's really hard to understand how difficult somebody can be.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. You also talk about, and I'll bet that there's more than a little of this that goes on, one quasi-psychopathic incompetent remaining on the campus payroll for over a dozen years, the supervisor afraid of being killed if he was fired.
Yeah, from what I've heard and from what I observed in talking with this person before I really knew that I probably would want to withdraw from talking with this person, he would kind of go around doing minor sabotage on equipment and so forth.
Oh.
Never really bad enough to, you know, to make it very, very obvious. But it was He was a scary individual, and I could see why that person would not want to fire him. I mean, you know, he feared for his own life. He really did. But at the same time, I think it would be really better if we did have better policies that made it easier to move out these people who are really obviously deeply disturbed.
And do you have any idea what those policies might be?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer to that question, but I think part of it is certainly from a university professor perspective, written policies that say, if you fear for your life or the life of your students, you should go and talk to this individual, communicate your concerns. Mm. Here's exactly how you do it. If there's other individuals, you know, here's how you can bring them all and kind of discuss this. A lot of times I think these situations are really a divide and conquer situation where you have one professor who knows that there's a real issue, and another one does also, but you really don't interact with one another, and so you don't really know that there's a big pattern going on. I know for me, when I was told, well, students have rights too, there's nothing you can do about it, I happened to mention it to a friend who is a professor in a different department, and she said, oh my goodness, I've had terrible problems with this person, and they restricted him so he couldn't go in my building. And I just thought, oh, well, that's awfully odd. And I think part of it was just that they really didn't think they could restrict him as easily into my building. And well, I've been an officer in the military and so forth, and I think they just thought, gosh, she can handle it.
Hmm.
And but it was really a little bit difficult to handle in that. There were these different policies, obviously, and different people were being told different things about what could be done. And again, that's where I think if universities had written guidelines and they had to submit things in writing,
mm-hmm.
I think administrators would also then feel much more like the problem really is theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think they can kind of say, well, you know, it's someone else's problem, but if there's written records that complaints have been submitted through formal channels, I think, and that it's trackable, I think administrators are more likely to pay attention.
Yeah. In the Virginia Tech case, we've heard about a couple teachers. Today it comes to light that there were as many as 8 teachers here who had formed, as many as 8 teachers in the last 18 months who had formed a task force to talk about how to handle this student. They got together frequently and talked among themselves about what to do here. And on 2 occasions, they went to university officials saying that this guy was trouble, but no action was taken by school administrators in response to their concerns. I mean, these teachers, we had a lot of them, and students as well, who had major concerns.
Well, I do think it's always hard to second guess when you're not on the scene yourself, and maybe those administrators knew things that that we're all unaware of. But I am aware that different campuses do seem to have really different policies, and I think part of that is the personality of the administrators. For example, I was on another campus teaching, and there was a student who, unbeknownst to me, was like a peeping Tom, and he was staring at, he was very clever. I watch my classes closely, and I'm really very cognizant of what's going on. But whenever my back would be turned, he would stare at the women next to him, and he'd sit right beside them, and he never paid attention. And then he was starting to stalk them, track them after classes and so forth. And when the students made me aware of that, they didn't even tell me through the course of the semester. And right towards the end, they made me aware, and I was like, oh, my goodness.
Mm.
And right then, I just said, okay, this fellow just will not go in my class anymore.
Hmm.
And so he slipped into my class, as he generally did, and I said, nope, you're not authorized to be in
really?
Class anymore.
Huh.
And he refused to leave. And so I called the police.
Huh.
And the police came, hauled him off, took him off campus, and he was never authorized on that campus again.
Hmm.
And I just thought, gosh, if only all of them were dealt with in this
mm-hmm.
way. Now, it could be that this fellow had such a bad record that I wasn't aware of, which is very conceivable, that it could have been that was the final straw.
Mm-hmm.
But it just made it clear to me that in some instances, universities act very expeditiously, depending on, again, I think what their internal policies and, you know, how much the administrators are really focusing and aware of the issues that we're experiencing.
I would imagine, maybe I'm wrong, that there will be many universities that will start gathering to talk about these very issues. Don't you think, as a result of this, Professor Oakley?
I'm sure that they will. I mean, no one ever, even no one would have ever wanted this to have happened, and everyone will be doing everything they can to think up good methods for avoiding this kind of
right.
thing. I guess my real concern is, and that's why I wrote my book, Evil Genes, is that some of these folks, it's pretty clear that in Sung Hui Cho's case, he was congenitally impaired. His ability to empathize with others has never been present. He's a really disturbed individual,
mm-hmm.
and there's really not much that could have been done about it. Our neuroscience, psychiatric and psychological capabilities there's only so much that can be done before a person, you know, you just kind of lock them away because we just don't have the current capabilities. And I think with that there are folks like this out there and kind of doing outreach to the community and reducing violence and so forth on television, those are great, but the really direct way to handle this is to become much more cognizant that some people really are disturbed and you have to be aware of them and you have to take action to get them away from others if safety is an issue.
And then we had a forensic psychiatrist on before you, and he said he was making some really strong points about this, about the network showing video of this guy and how it inspires just the people you were just talking about who are delusional, who are extremely sick, that we bear a responsibility to keep those images because it empowers them, in a sense, so that maybe years from now, as they will remember what happened this week and they will become empowered by seeing this guy becoming empowered in this weird way because he's given validation on television, so that we need to look at the whole issue of exposing that kind of violence and look at the psychological implications of some of the actions that we're taking in the press as well.
Well, I do think that's true. You know, I mean, movies like Kill Bill and Pulp Fiction and...
Yes, I agree. What are they all about?
Yeah, they maybe don't send the best example. But on the other hand, too, it's also important to recognize, I mean, some people, they've done studies on really altruistic people. And they found that really altruistic people have centers of their brain that are really more highly activated.
Hmm.
On the other hand, psychopaths have areas that of the brain that simply just don't function properly. Those kind of people, they don't have empathy for others. They may be attracted to the more violent kinds of shows naturally, but it's already there. One suspects that even with minimal, stimulation of that sort, that they would still be just as troubled as they are. So I think it's most important to go directly to the issue of some people really have problems that we can't fix, and we need to get them out of society just for the safety of others.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Professor Barbara Oakley is our guest, professor of engineering at Oakland University, author of Evil Genes, the book that is forthcoming, and also author of a piece in yesterday's New York Times. All right, let's go to your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about some of the ways that global warming has already affected wildlife. We will have two guests with us, a behavioral ecologist who is a member of the National Geographic Channel's Everyday Explorer team, and also the executive environmental editor at the National Geographic magazine. So that's coming up the second hour of our show. To your phone calls now for Professor Barbara Oakley, and we start with Dan from Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Kathleen. You know, some good is going to come out of this, because like Columbine, what happened there was that the safety of the students today in high schools and middle schools and grade schools is paramount, and it didn't seep up to the college level. The tolerance that high school teachers have for, quote, creative writing that involves heavy violence, it's non-existent today, and it will be non-existent in college, too. And I feel like, Professor, you were abused by the administrators there at the college you're talking about, because they weren't doing their job. You know, when you say that there's varying levels, well, there's varying types of bureaucrats in any administration, and there's some that do their job and some that don't. And the kind of lawsuits that are going to result out of the Virginia Tech thing, whether they're warranted or not, are going to make every administrator do that.
Barbara.
Dan, I couldn't agree more that I do think it's going to propagate upwards, and there's going to be much more awareness at college and university levels. I'm not so sure I was actually abused by administrators. I think part of it is a lot of administrators really haven't been aware of what kind of violence can result from these kinds of students. And so there aren't concrete policies. And I do think that's going to be changing. And administrators will be being made much more aware of a zero tolerance or very, very low tolerance of these kinds of dangerous activities by others. So I think you make a really good point, though, that there will be some good coming out of this.
Thanks, Dan, for your call. We go to Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Your guest, thank you for the call. Your guest said that lots of well-intentioned people are going to do their best to solve these problems. Well, as a faculty member in a large university system, I beg to disagree. What's going to happen is that there'll be a faculty-student task force, and they'll sit around and they'll make a report, and that will be the end of it until the next thing happens. We've been dealing, for example, with problems like violence against women in university social settings, like fraternities, date rape, and the like, and nobody does anything about that either. And I think the reason is because these matters are in our national gestalt. That is to say, violence is part of the propagation of our culture. And the fact that this young man was able to do such a horrific thing has to do a lot with the availability to him, the easy availability of high technology, that is, guns that can really kill fast. And if this guy had been limited to brandishing knives around, the body count would have been much, much smaller. On the other hand, you have just a little while ago, the Democrats and the Republicans getting together and saying, well, okay, we are not going to hold the gun industry liable for the dispersion of these killing machines in our midst and their easy availability. We want it that way. Violence is part of our culture, and this example is just something that crops up for the delectation of the chattering classes on television, and it is really disgusting.
Barbara.
Well, I guess, what happens is when a violent person like this erupts, you know, the immediate reaction of people is to say, well, we have to take away guns and so forth. But clearly, this is a very complex issue, and part of the problem, as you said, is that it's very, very hard for administrators to come to grips with this kind of situation. In that event, you can hardly blame teachers who kind of go, oh, gosh, I wouldn't mind getting a concealed weapon permit, especially if they do have someone hanging around who lives across the hall and puts cockroaches on their door and likes to follow them out to the car to make sure they're safe. I mean, it's you want to say, take all the guns away, but you also want to say, have the administrators act in an appropriate manner. Both things are never going to happen, really, I mean, in today's society. And I do think that a balance of, you know, maybe allowing a little bit of gun control, or non-gun control, I should say, just with respect to the fact that we know our society is such that we can't be, we can't stop these people. Things are set up administratively so that when safety is a concern, still people can't do anything.
So would you have felt more comfortable, Barbara, when this was going on, to have had a gun in your classroom?
I think so, to
really
tell you the truth. And I hate to say that, because I'd sure like to say that, you know, never, never, never. But it's just different when you're confronted with someone who is really a deeply disturbed person.
Mm-hmm.
I've had other people around here, like a 6'3" Hulk. I mean, this guy worked out all the time. Schizophrenic, bipolar, delusions of grandeur, harassing women all over the place. And, I mean, this guy was big and scary. And I'm sorry, there's nothing I could have done to stop him except have a gun at hand and hope that that would have worked. And again, I mean, people really did try to, you know, get this person gone, but it takes a while, and so it's a scary situation for faculty.
Thanks, Richard, for the call. Let's go to Tom next from Verona. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I got a couple points I want to make. First, about the difficulty of keeping a person locked up, but first, a little humorous story. A colleague of mine at Michigan State had a graduate student that came in with a gun, and said if he didn't get a passing good grade in his course, you know, he didn't know what he's going to do. So I said, Bob, what'd you do? He says, well, I gave him an A, and I turned him over to the dean's office, you know.
Oh, jeez.
But I want to talk about this fellow in Madison about 10 years ago, a young black fellow that was obviously schizophrenic, and he was put into counseling at the East High School and stuff like that. But after he graduated, they tried to keep him locked up, and he was in the custody of his aunt, and his aunt begged officials to keep him locked up and tried everything to keep him in an institution. But he took a can of gasoline, went on a city bus, and splashed it on a white couple and lit him on fire. I mean, what are you going to do about that? No guns, nothing. But, you know, this person should have been institutionalized, but the patients have so much rights now that people can't keep him in treatment.
Barbara.
Well, I really agree that deinstitutionalization has caused problems, and that needs to be rethought. It's just, I mean, I think many people know. I know individuals who one of their children, maybe out of three or four, is really a problem person who they've been told will go off and is eventually going to kill somebody. They know it, but there's nothing they can do about it because they can't go to the law to say lock them up because they don't really have the right cause to do that. I would be very much in favor of increasing, you know, reinstitutionalizing some folks who do need that kind of thing, because there are some people, and they are making incredible strides right now in knowing what goes on in some sorts of mental disorders. But at the same time, there's many things that still cannot be fixed. And until they can be fixed, I think it's pretty clear that some folks are really a danger, and it would be better if they were locked away.
Thanks very much for the call. But I guess it's still awfully difficult to determine how dangerous, right, that there are even among people who are very delusional, who are very, very sick, that there would just be a small minority, a very small minority, who would do the kind of act that we saw earlier this week.
Yes, but at the same time, again, part of the problem is there's a separation of people who know facts about a person. So, like at a university, unless there's a central way to get information about a problematic student, a lot of professors can know that this person could be a real safety issue, they're dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who's evaluating them is unaware of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, and you can't blame them. I mean, it's sometimes these folks are really good at play acting normalcy when they're in front, when they know they're being judged. And so I think if you had a repository where you stop this sort of separation of knowledge about a person's problems, then patterns would form that would make it much easier for folks to to make good decisions.
Yeah. And in this particular case, I mean, this was a student who never talked to anybody. Students wouldn't come to class because he was going to be in the class. There were so many problem areas all over the place, and for such a long period of time. We're not talking put on your best behavior. There never was any best behavior.
Right, right. Although, who's to know how, when he would go in front of that of whoever was evaluating him, well, he may not talk, but that doesn't give that evaluator any reason to think that he's really dangerous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so it's easy. So you can kind of understand why they would make such a terrible, terrible mistake in this individual's case.
Beth from Appleton. Hi.
Hi. This is Beth. I'm just calling to say I appreciate the complexity with which, your speaker is addressing this issue, because we're so into simple answers, and I appreciate that. I also wanted to talk about, or just have her think about, the studies that UW-Madison is doing with Buddhists in terms of the plasticity of the brain and looking at mental illness, hopefully in the future, maybe not now, but in the future, as something that, maybe looking at that research as a way into the mental illness issues, and also looking at, kind of what we feed ourselves. I wondered about a comment with altruism. You know, are these people more altruistic? Are they born that way, or are they made that way by what is sort of mentally fed them?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much for your comments, Beth. You bring up a fabulous issue that I discuss a lot in my book. My sister had polio. And it turns out that polio, in rare cases, with people with certain genetics, damages a certain little part of the brain called the reticular activating system. This system has a lot to do with your ability to focus and pay attention on what's going on. What they find with people who are, psychopathic in their personality is, like my sister, they often have either they're kind of pre-programmed genetically to have differences in the genes that help them focus and pay attention, or there might be minor damage through some sort of disease or even the birth process and so forth. This makes it so that, you can't these people can't concentrate and fix themselves through normal brain plasticity, which is really you can do incredible things with your brain by kind of thinking your way there.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do it because, first of all, they can't understand there's anything wrong with themselves. And second of all, they can't really focus on a problem. They think the problem is elsewhere. And so you can't get them to focus on trying to fix themselves because they simply cannot understand there's anything wrong with them. And you see that in the writings of Tsang Hui Cho. I mean, he was, all the problems were from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you can say he's right because we should have locked him up. But that's, these people, there's like two circuits in the brain. One is for self, one is for others. in many of these kinds of folks, the self circuit is turned way up.
Hmm.
So they're really narcissistic, and they do believe that any problems that happen are clearly somebody else's fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Professor Oakley, thank you so much for being with us this part of our program. I really appreciate
you.
Professor Barbara Oakley, professor of engineering at Oakland University, author of the forthcoming book, Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend. Her piece in The New York Times was yesterday, actually, in the op-ed section if you want to look it up. And thanks also to Dr. Michael Wellner, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at New York University School of Medicine, for being with us the first half of this hour. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda for on-air production as well and for all of your calls. Copies of the show, call the radio store, 800-747-7444, the program number 420D, 420D. I'm Kathleen Dunn, news ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.